Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know, a show empowering you with truthful information so you can make the more and most informed decisions possible. And boy, today's show is just an example of what the purpose is of this program, empowering you with truthful information so you can make informed decisions, because we have a powerful show in store for you today. I just want to remind everyone, if you have not yet liked me or friended me over on my Facebook page, What Women Must Know, please do that, because not only do these shows that I do on a weekly basis and my other show called The Love Code get posted there, but there's all sorts of other information that I share on that Facebook page. And also, you can opt into my website, drcherylselman.com, because I send the archive shows out to my list along with other information as well. So the way to just be sure you get these shows and also stay on top of all the resources and strategies and programs that I have developed and I'm offering to everyone. So hope you'll be joining me at Facebook page, What Women Must Know, or the website, Dr. Cheryl Selman. So let's talk about what to me is a really profound conversation, because my topic today is about a wake-up call, and it's the connection between polio, toxicity, and viruses with my guest, Sophia Smallstorm. So first of all, let me just say that as we delve into the situation we have found ourselves in all over the world with this pandemic, with this virus, with all of the information that we are discovering, causing us to really question so many things, causing us to really reevaluate who we trust, the information we are given, and the history of so many things that we have taken for granted, and yet it's time to really dive deep. It's time to get to the bottom of what is really going on, of what's really going to serve us, what's going to support our bodies to be strong and healthy, and to understand what is really going on. I always like to say it's really about peeking behind the curtain. And for some reason, that's just my nature. I just don't trust information, however it's coming to us, as face value, whether it's the media, whether it's scientific publications, whether it's politicians, you name it. It's just my nature. I'm a bit suspect of what is being said until I can really evaluate it from all angles. And with this COVID pandemic situation, with the vaccine that's being proposed, threatened in some cases, it has gotten me on the hunt. What's really going on? What's behind the scenes? What do we find when we go peek behind the curtain? So today's conversation is going to do that. And Sophia Smallstorm is a brilliant researcher. A little bit about her. She is an independent researcher who has written and presented extensively on hidden agendas and complex events since her work on 9/11. In the process of researching the topic, she discovered the phenomenon of artificial clouds and geoengineering, or chemtrails. From this, she came to acknowledge the presence of a synthetic biology agenda and the activities that constitute everyday life. In 2013, she began researching corporate government, the legal doctrine, and parens patriae, technology, and the smart control grid, and the impact these are having on public freedom and public health. So we have quite a deep dive today. I'm so glad you're with us, and I'm especially so thrilled to have Sophia Smallstorm with us today. So hello and welcome, Sophia.
Hi, thank you so much, Dr. Selman, Cheryl, for having me on. I'm very gratified and honored, and I hope that we can't just peek behind the curtain, that we rip it back, because that's what it needs, right?
Well, I'm all for ripping it back, so let's just do the full thing, the full rip. So Sophia, you have delved really deeply into these topics, and I'm just curious to just begin our conversation. What motivated you to dive that deep, to rip the curtain from so many of these issues that when you investigated them, they are certainly not what they were presented to be? And by the way, the other day, I just have to say, I'm very aware of chemtrails. I've been aware of chemtrails for a long time. And it's just so sad. I walked outside the other day. It was a beautiful day, beautiful blue skies. And there they were, not just crisscrossing, but making U-turns and just covering, in the end, the entire sky with this cloud that blocked out the sun. So if anyone just looks up in their neighborhood, they will see at some point in time these chemtrails. But we're not going to talk about chemtrails today. We're going to talk about something that's much more present and of concern for people, not that chemtrails aren't, but we're going to keep our focus on the story of viruses and polio and toxicity and an untold story that needs to be told. So
yes, and
that was my
actually,
long,
you know,
question. Go ahead.
You asked what got me into it, and what got me into it, into researching or being actively curious. I mean, you can be curious, you can say, what if, and then your attention is distracted, and you always have a what if kind of blipping away in your mind, maybe many, but you never take the trouble to look up what is the answer to your what if question. And I am a perpetual what if person. What if this, what if that? And it seemed to me, growing up, that the world was just too simple, the way it was explained to me. And I would say to my mother when I was a little girl, like 10 years old, I would say, do all the governments just get along? Do they have meetings? What do they do? How does it all work? And my mother would look at me and she wouldn't even know where to start, and because she couldn't explain it. And then I realized as I got older that there's actually a hierarchic setup in the world, and governments have to, they're pawns of a bigger system, right? And that system has complete control of science, and it's falsifying a lot of information that we're given. History has been rewritten. Science is being kind of inverted and made too simplistic. For instance, when I learned more about the germ theory of disease, and it was explained to me by an amazing researcher, Jennifer Lake, who's a good friend, that they wanted to actually match one pharmaceutical drug to a particular disease. And they were blaming these diseases on germs. So you could extend that theory to say there was a germ that created a disease, and for that we needed a drug. And this was part of the Manhattan Project, as she explained it to me. The Manhattan Project did not end after we invented the bomb and World War II was over. The Manhattan Project is ongoing. In fact, I would say that we are in phase 4 of the Manhattan Project right now.
Okay, so we have to go back to the beginning. So if Manhattan Project is the beginning of this story, let's start there.
Okay, so we had, during that time, the Manhattan Project, let's say it began around 1940-something, and World War II, centering on World War II. We did have, out of the Manhattan Project, the development of what was called the Salk polio vaccine. And people thought at the time that Jonas Salk was a pediatrician, but he was not. He was, in fact, a radiation biologist. He was a scientist. And what happened around the time of the Manhattan Project, it was such a big program that many of our universities, our research labs, for instance, cancer centers, for instance, Sloan Kettering, the whole UC chain, the various big labs like at the Tuskegee Institute was one of them in the South. These were all formed by the Manhattan Project. They were Manhattan Project hubs. And they were using different forms of radiation to try different kinds of things. They used particle accelerators on sick people. There's a terrible story of a tiny little boy, 4 years old, and the particle accelerator at Stanford was fired at his right eye. He had some eye issue, maybe a cancer. And they irradiated him in the eye for weeks. And what happened? Of course, he went blind and he probably died. But this is the kind of experimentation they were doing on people. And it was all supposedly to become progressive with science. And that was the beginning of the radiation biology age, really. And we continue to be moved through that. Wireless radiation is another phase of the Manhattan Project, all the cell phones and the technologies we're using. But anyway, to go back even further and not to confuse people, we had a disease that was called palsy. You're familiar with that word, I'm sure, right?
Right.
Palsy right. was
it's
a
like
disease.
Your muscle, you have weak muscles. You know, we know Bell's palsy, right? The muscles
right.
in the face just collapse.
It was a term given to crippling in small children often. Development, motor development was very, very impaired, and people didn't really know why. But then I would just say the powers that be became aware that where they were spraying chemical pesticides in apple orchards in New England, children living in those areas near those apple orchards were developing this palsy, weak muscles and crippling. And did that stop them from developing their chemical pesticides? No. They continued to spray the pesticides, kept this relationship in mind with this affliction that appeared in children who were in these areas where pesticides were being experimented with on orchards and crops. And later, as this continued, it became very clear. Anyone who put two and two together would be able to conclude that chemicals are causing damage in developing humans, particularly children, chemical exposure. So this palsy term became another umbrella term called poliomyelitis. Polio was the umbrella term that covered a lot of different afflictions showing up in children and even in adults throughout the first half of the 1900s. And so that generated an interest in developing this polio vaccine. And there is a huge, huge story around the development of the polio vaccine. The idea, you know, we have to go back to the days of smallpox. Jenner, I believe, was the guy who invented the smallpox vaccine or tried to, when in fact smallpox was not eradicated by any vaccine. It was actually carried by bed bugs and in dirty blankets, specifically that were given to Indians. There's a very famous story around that in history, that Native Americans contracted smallpox from these blankets that were given to them by the white men. But smallpox, polio, all of these are very, very different. Polio is expressed in the muscles, the nerves, and polio is a very large umbrella term, where smallpox is an expression of the skin. So let's just say that toxins are expressed by our skin in the form of rashes. We often get rashes and flu-like symptoms whenever our bodies are challenged. Flu-like symptoms, flu is not flu. Flu is not something caused by a virus. Flu is a systemic takedown, and your body goes, oh my gosh, something's happening to me. I got to run a fever here. I got to do some basic triage here, basic covering what needs to be done, what might be hurting. I've got to look into things. So that's the flu. And a lot of people who contracted polio had these flu-like symptoms at first, all right? So the polio vaccine was launched. It was presented to the world in the 1950s. Yet, in spite of 400,000 children that were inoculated with this vaccine, the Salk vaccine, polio continued. It just continued. It continued to blossom and bloom all over the place. So there's a very famous researcher, Janine, J-A-N-I-N-E, Roberts, and she wrote a book called Fear of the Invisible, but there's also a truncated version of that book, an article called A Shot in the Dark, which is on the internet. So they launched the polio vaccine, and polio cases continued to go on in vaccinated children, and this caused panic in the White House. So they had a meeting. They couldn't be embarrassed. The president didn't want to be embarrassed. And they met with, in the White House, they met with the Salk manufacturers, the Surgeon General, and they decided that they were going to be discredited unless they did something very radical, and it was very creative. The U.S. health authorities had to slash the incidence of poliomyelitis. They couldn't say, oh, we continue to have polio. So they changed the way they recorded polio cases. So prior to 1956, if you had paralytic polio, also called infantile paralysis, and if you had these paralytic symptoms for one day, 24 hours, you were written down, noted down as a polio patient, poliomyelitis patient. But after 1956, literally pretty much overnight, you had to have symptoms of paralysis for 60 days to be counted as having polio. So that's when polio, the real thing, the umbrella disease, got a raft of new names. They came up with aseptic meningitis. Suddenly people had aseptic meningitis. They had Guillain-Barré syndrome. They had hand, foot, and mouth disease. They had something called non-poliomyelitis acute flaccid paralysis, but they didn't have polio. So the fact is, today, we are still in a polio epidemic. We have diseases showing up late in life when our toxicity load has aggregated, and it starts affecting nervous system signaling. It affects myelination. It affects skeletal muscles. It affects all kinds of things. And these diseases are known as ALS, MS, muscular dystrophy, cerebral palsy, all these diseases for which you see so many charities. And people, we're told these diseases are, you know, genetic. This is the new thing. Oh, it's all genetic. But it's not. I know someone who had ALS, which before 1956 would be called polio, no question about it. And I asked him, what did you do as a young man? Well, he was a house painter his whole life. And you remember when we worked with very strong solvents for oil-based paints, paints that contained lead? So he had had heavy chemical exposure all his life. So chemical exposure and exposure to radiation. The age of radiation is the age we're in today, and a lot of our symptoms of, you know, these genetic diseases that we're developing, for instance, MS, multiple sclerosis, would have been considered poliomyelitis at one time.
Well, so a couple of questions. Let's start with the connection between toxic exposure and how it impacts the body and creates these conditions, which we call diseases. And polio is a perfect example. And I was sharing with you before the show that I was listening to a testimony by Dr. Robert O. Young. And he, in his testimony about his understanding of the nature of diseases and illnesses, showed a graph of exposure to DDT. So when they started using DDT, you know, I have friends who, as children, remember those fogging machines. They used to go up and down the streets. This is, you know, we're talking 60 years ago or so, going up and down the streets, spraying DDT. And he said he remembers as a kid playing behind those fogging machines in the cloud of DDT. So DDT was spread up and down streets all over the place. And as DDT increased its use, Dr. Young showed the graph that polio increased concurrently. So more DDT used in the environment, higher the curve of polio, the incidence of polio. And then when it became evident at a certain point that DDT was a really toxic and dangerous pesticide and the use declined, so did the curve decline of polio until it flattened out. When DDT was out of use, then polio was at its lowest. So that was such a shocking visual, you know, understanding of this correlation between impact of these extremely harmful, dangerous, toxic chemicals that are in the environment, and the correlation and I would say the cause and its impact on the body, and then it was given a name rather than identified as a consequence and a side effect, and a damaging side effect from exposure to these chemicals. Can you elaborate on that, Sophia?
Well, I did watch some footage from way back in the 50s when they were doing all this DDT spraying. And I was shocked to see and to read also that they would go drive by public swimming pools, you know, and all the little children in July, this would be like New York City swimming pools, city public swimming pools in cities, just crowded with children, and the truck would spray all the kids with DDT. They also had shakers, the way you would shake Parmesan cheese onto pasta, mothers would shake DDT into their children's sandwiches that they were making for their lunch. So this absolutely, today it defies all logic. I don't even think there would be a parent alive who would do such a thing. But back then they thought it was helpful. They had worked very, very hard in advertising to create this household, this housewife, the profile of the industrious housewife who was chasing germs out of her house with chemical cleaners. They got us using bleach. They got us polishing everything. And germs were the villain of life. And it was chemicals that stopped germs, because germs, for the most part, microbes and germs are bacteria, and bacteria don't do well in the presence of high heat. This is why we cook our food and boil water, for instance, and they don't do well in the presence of harsh chemicals. So DDT, when you mentioned that there was a correlation in the graph between use of DDT and the incidence of polio, and when they stopped using DDT, polio went down, let's not forget that what you're really doing is you are twinning two words, DDT and polio. But what if the condition known as polio had been renamed, had been given all kinds of different names, which is in fact what happened? Now, when they cut down DDT use, we can say, well, polio has gone down. But the fact is polio continued. It continued as aseptic meningitis. It continued as Guillain-Barré syndrome. But that's not going to show up on the graph because those are different names for polio. So polio has continually been renamed. And polio was, you know, alive and well when they were doing the Nevada testing and all the nuclear tests throughout the world. And what Jenny Lake, the researcher, taught me, you can see her website, her blog, polioforever.wordpress.com, and also jenniferlake.wordpress.com. And these blogs are, they're kind of like her ongoing notebooks. There's tremendous amounts of information, links, very good detective material for people who like to put things together. But they were also pairing radiation nuclear testing events with shipments of different types of vaccines, because the pairing of vaccine administration and exposure to radiation really crashed people's immune systems. So the profile of immune defense changed radically in the 1950s. And this, in Lake's theory, has given rise to so many issues which we have been told are genetic diseases, modern diseases. You know, they've come up with all these modern genetic diseases, which are basically, there's a lot of autoimmune stuff, lupus, Epstein-Barr, all of these chronic diseases that are autoimmune in nature, fibromyalgia. They are actually other forms of polio resulting from vaccination and radiation. So chemicals, radiation, and then the intrusion of vaccines into our bodies, which bring very complex molecules directly into the bloodstream. And that confuses the Th2 immune system and gets our antibody production to go into massive overdrive. That's the origin of a lot of the autoimmune disease you're seeing today.
Okay, so let's put this together. So first of all, the introduction of radiation into the planet, I mean, when those tests were done, that radiation didn't just stay in Nevada, didn't just stay in Japan when they dropped that bomb, and all the testing that has gone on ever since has now, and then, of course, now in present times is Fukushima, all that radiation from, you know, since the 1940s has permeated throughout the planet. And as we know, it is highly damaging, carcinogenic, immune suppressing. So there's there's that piece. So we had, so our health began to change radically at that point when radiation began to permeate throughout the world, throughout, you know, radiation dropped into the soil, into the water. We brought it into our bodies. So that's one strand of this story. Second strand is when chemicals, when pesticides began to be manufactured and used in widespread applications throughout the world, really, but certainly in Western countries, but anywhere where they were choosing to use the chemical pesticides. So the chemicals that were sprayed, chemicals that were put into the soil, that were put into the atmosphere, now compounded the body's ability to function in the presence of poisons. So we have, you know, two universal poisons, and of course the pesticides, the herbicides, the fungicides, and, you know, all the other toxic chemicals that we use in our environment, in our home, are just adding to this toxic load, which is further weakening the body. And as a result, the toxins from these various chemicals affect and attack the body in specific ways. Each chemical may have a specific way. Polio being one of paralysis, and the nervous system being damaged was directly related to DDT, maybe compounded by the radiation exposure. So we now keep adding more chemicals to the environment. Now there's so much research about Roundup, its other name is glyphosate, how damaging and destructive that is. So this is a universal model you're sharing with us, Sophia, a universal understanding of what is really, truly pushing these chronic conditions that are given different names and treated as separate genetic defects or other conditions. But really, it has become the result of choosing to create a modern world based on toxic chemicals. Do I have that right?
Yes, and I would throw in here, again, the picture can continually expand, and I think the good thinker keeps their mind open for more and more strands, as you call them, to the fabric that is being woven. And I would throw in or add in electricity, because we have highly electrified lives now. We have electrification in our homes. We are constantly using devices that operate on wireless transmissions. You know, that's a form of electricity. Those are all electromagnetic waves that create electromagnetic fields. So when we electrified our world, we had massive, massive explosions of this thing called flu. The Spanish flu was not a flu. This is why we have to redefine flu. And I would like to draw attention to a really brilliant book written by Arthur Furstenberg in 2017, called The Invisible Rainbow. And this book is absolutely stunning. It will explain to you how electricity has changed our biology and how hard it has hit our biology. So radiation is part of that whole platform, as are chemicals, as is electricity. And electricity is not something, you know, non-lethal and mild that enhances our lives. Electricity affects our own bioelectricity.
All right. I interviewed Arthur over a year ago. I should probably replay that interview because it's becoming much more recognized, the role of EMS, and now as we're moving into the 5G world, that's really getting people's attention. So we need to understand that EMF is a form of radiation. It's a microwave radiation. It's still frequencies of extreme harmful effects on the cells. So let's just tie in one more piece, Sophia. So we talked about this overarching change in our world and correlating it with the rise of these epidemics that didn't happen before these changes existed, and then were defined as pandemics, and then they needed to find the solution. So we created the polio vaccine, the measles vaccines. Of course, now vaccines are just, now we're faced with the fear that so many people have that this concocted vaccine that they're promising us for COVID-19, which will be mandated, is really, creating huge anxiety for so many people who are aware. Can we then weave in this web we're discussing the role or the creation or the myths around the vaccine for polio and how it is relevant for us today?
Well, we first have to draw in another little critter that they invented, basically, once they had the electron microscope. And this would be the virus. Because bacteria are pretty easy to kill. You spray a chemical on them like bleach and they're gone. You boil something in water or cook it at high heat and bacteria are gone. So they developed this concept that bacteria had a cousin called virus. A virus was not alive, it was inorganic, but it had a way to get into a cell. They call it infecting a cell. And then it would go inside and it would replicate itself and it would completely toxify and overpower the cell and kill it. So they came up with viral disease causation after they introduced and pushed the germ theory of disease for quite a while, effectively, and launched their, domestication of chemicals. Those would be our Lysol and Clorox and that kind of thing. So we are now being, again, bamboozled into thinking that viruses outpace science. They can mutate every season. They're so tricky, so stealthy, so tiny. Nobody can keep a pace with them. And they're constantly changing, and we constantly have to create these methods of getting back at them, which would be the whole vaccine industry. And, I have to say that we have been conditioned to believe that viruses, they don't just infect us, they infect our computers. I mean, this is a different kind of virus, but there is a languaging that has been very reinforcing in our culture. Wouldn't you agree? You don't want a computer virus. It will ruin your computer. You have to get antivirus programs to run in the background of your computer, or else all your data will be lost. So that virus and then the biological virus, we have been very well conditioned to fear viruses.
That's so interesting. I mean, we could have called what goes on in our computers glitches. We could have created another name. We could have called it all sorts of things, but instead it was termed a virus, which would just reinforce the existence of these things that infect us that are cause so much damage. It's an interesting observation, Sophia, that term is used.
Yeah, isn't it? I mean, that hit me just a little while ago. They've got us really conditioned. And virus comes from the Greek word for poison. So it's the Universal Historical Dictionary of 1955 defines it as slimy liquid poison, a poisonous substance produced in the body as a result of some disease. Now, first of all, I just want to say this. There's only one disease. And that disease is the failure of the mitochondria in your cells to produce adequate energy, or ATP, for that cell. Now, you have injury to cells. You have all kinds of cells in your bodies, all different kinds of cells, and they inhabit all different kinds of tissues and all different kinds of structures and organs and parts of your body. So depending on where the damage to the cells shows up, it's given a name. That name is a disease. So if you have a disease in certain tissues of the eye, damage in certain tissues of the eye, that's given a disease name. Damage in certain tissues of the intestine, that's given a disease name. But it's always the same kind of thing. The mitochondria in the cell, which are the energy-producing organelles of the cell, it's like the engine in the car. If your engine goes out, your car cannot be driven. But if the engine goes out in a Ford or the engine goes out in a Ferrari, is it a different disease?
Right. 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 Yeah. And so, I mean, we're, I was just going to add that more integrative models of health, or more holistic models of health, are understanding how crucial the mitochondria are. Many conditions are now called mitochondrial disease because we have been damaging the power centers of our cells, and therefore they cannot function, they cannot detoxify, they can't regenerate, they can't heal, they can't repair. So it shows up in different ways depending on, you know, our vulnerabilities, I guess you would say, and degree of toxicity or the comorbidities, how many conditions we have or how many toxic exposures we have. So, it, you know, the more we are burdening our bodies, the more we are accumulating through our food, through our environment, through our Wi-Fi world, through our fears, through our lack of harmony and balance, through anger, through all of physical, emotional, and mental components, the more we create vulnerabilities that generate the chaos in our bodies that get named as a disease.
Exactly right. That's right. And a lot of this is in the name of progress. I remember when I was a little kid and you had this creepy stuff, luncheon meat it was called, and you sliced it and you heated it up and you put it in a sandwich. I mean, I'm vegan now, but back then I wasn't. And there was all kinds of canned food, and there was something called Dream Whip, which is a white powder in a bag and in a box. And you added, oh my God, it tasted amazing. My brother and I would beg my mother, could we just have Dream Whip for breakfast, you know? Spoonfuls of it.
And a good chemical concoction.
I know. This chemical food, I remember parents and even we as little kids would say, oh, one day we're not even going to have to eat. Nobody will have to cook. You just take a pill, and that's your lunch. You take another pill, and that's dinner. And the whole culture was forward-thinking in this crazy way, right?
Right.
And that was right before gourmet restaurants and the Food Network, but not that I am a subscriber to much television here. But anyway, so our culture, our modern life, was, we were told it was for purposes of progress. We would live longer if we had clean houses. And the fact is that what really lengthened our lives and dramatically improved our health, there's a very famous book by a French physician who taught at Harvard, René Dubos, D-U-B-O-S, called The Mirage of Health. And I read that book. It was recommended to me by an MD that I was working with many, many years ago. And that book put out the fact that, sorry, it's not medicine and medical research that has improved our health. It was two very simple things. The introduction of glass windows into houses, which brought in warmth and sunlight. Before glass windows, houses didn't have a lot of openings, and they were very dark and dank, and all kinds of microbes would proliferate. And people, you know, they lived in these damp, dark conditions, didn't get a lot of sunlight. And that's a huge factor in staying healthy. You've got to have light. You cannot be living in dank, dampness, darkness. And that's what I call, there's biological, you know, photobiology will shed more explanation on that. We can do a show someday maybe. But that, the glass windows in houses, and guess what else? Changing your underwear every day and laundering it continually. Those two things. And running water, those three things, that really helped the disease profile of humanity.
So interesting. Changing your underwear, who knew?
Who knew? I read somewhere that Appalachian children had their underwear sewn on for the winter.
Oh, interesting. Oh, yeah.
It was loose. I know. It was loose. You could pull it aside and use the outhouse. But anyway, so, I mean, same concepts that you and I are going, what? Because we don't even think about it.
So let's go back to the polio vaccine.
Yes.
Story. Because that lays the foundation for why vaccinations are so flawed.
Okay. So around the time of the polio vaccine, we had the, right before it, we had the electron microscope as well. And the electron microscope was one of the favorite tools of the virus hunters. And it was pushed heavily by some of what I saw, the Manhattan Project biggies. But the electron microscope allowed people to see at very high magnification materials that showed up in the blood of sick people. And these materials were crystalline in nature. They were proteinaceous as well. They were smaller than the cell itself. And what people failed to put together was, were they produced when tissues were diseased as a consequence, or were they causing the disease? So the original experiments done with vaccines were absolutely horrific. They would inject horrible, like really fetid biological materials into the brains of monkeys, into even into people's bodies, and see whether that caused any kind of immunity. They would put stuff up monkeys' noses. They used a lot of monkeys. And I'm trying to see where this, where I have it in my newsletter, but how many different novel ways of doing things. You know, the early virus hunters were Landsteiner, Rivers, Thomas Rivers. There were the Flexner brothers were at the Rockefeller Institute in you know, positions directing the virology department. And that's where they established that viruses were different from bacteria. And so this birthed a whole new kind of path of scientific study. And they decided that viruses were behind this paralysis thing, these paralysis situations. But again, were they or weren't they? And they started to do these horrible experiments on monkeys, and when they used their early electron microscopes, they decided that these fuzzy white spheres were the cause of polio, because under the microscope the virus looked like it looked like a little corona, okay? So they, back in this time period, now this is very far, this is before even the 1950s, they decided to look for viruses instead of toxins as the source of disease outbreaks, because this gave the pharmaceutical industry a whole new growth, path of growth. So
let me just jump in here, ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, based on your research, do you think that back then it was known that these chemicals that were becoming pervasive in the environment were harmful, and that the emerging pharmaceutical industry took advantage of it to further their gains and ignored the toxicity component, or were they just ignorant and thought something else was driving this?
I think they knew it, because look at what pharmaceutical companies make. Not only do they make the chemicals that make us sick, like the pesticides, but then they make the drugs. The chemical companies make the agricultural products, they make the products for war, but they also make the drugs that are supposed to cure us. So it's like funding both sides of the war. Thank
But,
you.
and this is, right. So, you know, I was listening to some interviews around this polio virus where they had a theory, right? There was this virus that created polio. And the researchers at the time, I can't remember who the main person was, I mean, tried desperately to inflict polio into the subjects, I mean, into the brains, you said, of monkeys. They literally would, you know, put this substance that they came from an infected person into the brain of a monkey. They would feed them. They would do everything without any success in generating polio.
So, well, let me just say this. They did kill off these monkeys. I'll just read you here. I found it in my newsletter. So I said that the materials used in early vaccine development are kind of like, you can picture the scenario of drunk screenwriters working on the details of a gross screenplay. So they would inject diseased mouse brain tissues mixed with rabbit serum into healthy mice through their nose intranasally, diseased and desiccated human spinal cords into living creatures, rabbit brains suspended in phenol, which is toxic, and the contents of intestines, then intranasal injections into animals of human stools, feces in saline solution popped into rhesus monkeys' brains. So the animal subjects of these experiments quickly became very ill and died, and some were also paralyzed. Now, is that a surprise if you're pumping organic waste into the brain? No. So this was considered proof of polio transmission by viral exposure.
Ooh, I wouldn't trust that one.
Yeah. But, you know, paralysis, this is from Jenny Lake's blog. Paralytic polio was a rare disease before the industrial age, but palsies were not uncommon and known to be caused by toxic medicines containing mercury, arsenic, and other assorted ingredients, referred to as mercurial diseases. Examples of toxic paralysis are all around us in nature. Snakes, spiders, species of fish emit potent neurotoxins as a means of food gathering and survival defense, right? So this may be where we got that relationship with virus and poison from the natural world.
So so let's wrap all this up. Let's take all these strands and weave them together, kind of, you know, at this point in our conversation, to create the overview of what people really are learning from our conversation and need to be aware of in the days ahead, and understanding what really is generating and contributing to imbalances in their bodies, which we can call diseases or the flu or whatever name
right.
we want to give it.
So we have identified lots of different strands that all weave into this fabric or platform of what causes the body to go into precipitous decline if the exposure is acute enough. If it's not an acute exposure and it happens over time, then the body crashes or degenerates slowly, right? Those are our neurodegenerative diseases. The body is going to crash, according to the electrobiophysicist Dr. Gaetan Chevalier, who I had conferred with several years ago. He said, your body's going to crash. It's either going to crash all at once or it's going to crash slowly. But it's going to crash. It's very hard for us to thrive in this modern environment. But we're propped up by the pharmaceutical industry and our doctors who keep pumping us with suggestions and different medications. And this is why old people are hobbling around taking 20 different drugs a day, right? So in order to really wrap up our discussion, I want to explain something else about viruses, which is very, very interesting. What were these viral hunters looking at? So when you go back to the very early days of virology, 1892, there was a Russian botanist, Dmitry Ivanovsky. He's considered one of the founding fathers of virology. And there is something that hits a lot of different plants called tobacco mosaic virus, TMV. This is also called spot disease. And Ivanovsky managed to transfer this spot stuff from sick plants to healthy ones. And he looked under the microscope, whatever he had, and he determined that even though you couldn't really see this stuff, it was the cause of the sickness. So that, again, he didn't ask, is this material showing up because the plant is ailing, or is it causing the plant to ail? But what's very, very important in the history of TMV, tobacco mosaic virus, is that, first of all, it doesn't kill plants. It only seems to stunt them. And it doesn't just affect tobacco. It affects tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, ornamental flowers like orchids, and the leaves will crinkle and pucker and show dead areas. Now, I'm just a regular person. I'm no white coat working in a lab. I simply went to Wikipedia. I read about tobacco mosaic virus because it was one of the earliest viruses they ever worked on. And what do you think I found at the bottom of the page? On Wikipedia, under investigational uses, they've actually changed that title now, but it's still at the bottom of the page. Due to its cylindrical shape, high aspect ratio, self-assembling nature, and ability to incorporate metal coatings like nickel and cobalt into its shell, tobacco mosaic virus is an ideal candidate to be incorporated into battery electrodes. Addition of tobacco mosaic virus to a battery electrode increases the reactive surface area by an order of magnitude, resulting in an increase in the battery's capacity by up to 6 times. So I said to myself, gosh, you just smear this stuff on a battery electrode and you get 6 times the power? What does that mean about tobacco mosaic virus? To me, it meant that it's a bioelectric product. And in my creative brain, I said, what if these viruses, subcellular crystalline components, go into cells and we're told they infect a cell and they replicate? What if they are piezoelectric? They're electromagnetic. When they bump against a cell, they release voltage. They give that cell electrons. And the cell says, welcome, welcome, I need this electricity because I'm dying. I've got to have these electrons. Bump around in me. Make more of yourself. So that's when I realized we might be on the wrong path altogether with what a virus is. Healing is voltage. You can read that in the work of many, many researchers. Dr. Tennant, Jerry Tennant is one, bioelectricity. So maybe that's what a virus does. It's this thing that moves around in our bodies as a consequence of disease forming, ailments happening, and these little viral things with their coronas, they bump into our cells and they release electrons and we get more cellular electricity and then we start to heal.
Well, that's an interesting thought for sure. The most important message I have from what you have been sharing with us today is that we are really in a system that has been poisoned for, 100 years or more. And in our Western societies where we have created these toxic chemicals, pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, the radiation, toxic foods, these toxic chemicals, heavy metals that have been injected into us along with whatever attenuated virus supposedly is in there directly into our systems. We have messed around with nature. We are nature. We have been experimenting with our environment and with our bodies. And we have such an incidence of chronic diseases everywhere now that, to me, it's telling us, it's the result of the fact that we have poisoned ourselves and poisoned our environment, our air, our food, our water, because of agendas that have moved us in this direction, because of lies that we've been told that have allowed us to acquiesce to agendas that are profiting and whatever other agendas there may be in place. And, you know, we're literally frogs just quietly boiling away in the pot, not realizing that everything that is occurring that is compromising our health and ability to function may, in fact, be the result of the poisoning that has gone on for the last 100 years into our air, food, water, soil, and minds. And that's why your message is so important, Sophia, because this is the time where people have to wake up. That's why I titled our conversation A Wake-Up Call, because people have to start questioning, start delving, start looking, start opening your mind, and especially start connecting with the powers that exist within us that have the ability to heal, repair, regenerate, and not expect an outside force like a vaccine that's going to protect us. It will not do that. It will just lead to more trauma and drama and deaths down the track. So, you know, to open up people's minds, to get people questioning, thinking, going deeper, which you do so well, is so vital at this time. This is absolutely critical for all of us to start doing and discovering that maybe some of the beliefs we've held or some of the beliefs that have been put into our minds through all the propaganda vehicles on television, radio, news, everywhere, are not the truth, and that we need to follow a path of restoring balance and harmony to ourselves, to our planet, to our lives. So this is, you know, for me, a really profound conversation, and I'm really very grateful to you for putting all the time and energy into delving really deeply, going deeply down that rabbit hole to help put pieces together of a big mystery that is now, in my mind, getting really clear, right? It's all coming into focus. And that way we can make better choices for ourselves and our future. So thank you, Sophia Smallstorm, for being with us today. If people want to know more about Sophia's work, and she's very prolific and going down the rabbit hole, just go to sophiasmallstorm.com, Sophia, S-O-F-I-A, sophiasmallstorm.com. Do you have just, we just have a minute left. Do you want to just have a concluding comment, Sophia?
Yes, I also have an online store, avatarproducts.com, and I share a lot of things there that have helped me personally. I call it a bioremediation store. There are cell phone shielding cases. My top sellers are iodine, magnesium, and a fantastic product called Restore. And they help in very basic ways with putting ourselves back on track in terms of, you know, just getting functional again. And they're not that expensive either. I mean, we cannot afford to try so many different formulations and bankrupt ourselves because we don't know what direction we're going in. So, yeah, Avatar Products is my store. Sophia Smallstorm is my blog. And I have a newsletter which you can subscribe to as well. You'll find that on the sophiasmallstorm.com website. And I just want to thank you, Dr. Cheryl Selman, for having me on. This was my first time, but I think we had a very good discussion, and I was able to pull some things together. It's always good to have a refresher, because you think on your toes in these shows, you know, actually rhymed.
Well, you did a great job pulling it all together, because you really wove a very comprehensive picture of the big picture, and that's what we need, the big picture. We sometimes get too focused on the minutiae. We have to pull out wide focus. So
yeah.
Thanks so much again for your time today and for your great work. All the best to you. And all the best to my listeners who are joining me. So please join me every week. Remember Facebook, What Women Must Know, and also drcherylselman.com. Until next time, remember to always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.